Warren Buffett, BlackRock, and other institutional players dominate investments in commercial aviation. Why? Because it's one of the most profitable and predictable alternative assets that exists. And it's not tied to other markets, such as real estate and the stock market. Is it safe? Well, imagine triple net leases to the likes of American Airlines and British Airways. Income is contractual and guaranteed by some of the biggest named airlines in the world. That's why this kind of investment was never available to the ordinary accredited investor. That is until now. Visit accesswealthaviation.com and check it out for yourself. Invest in an institutional team with over 200 plus years of combined investment experience in the aviation sector. Conservative investing with double-digit returns and tax advantages. That's accesswealthaviation.com. accesswealthaviation.com.
You are listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast with Buck Joffrey. Get ready to change your life.
Welcome, everybody. This is Buck Joffrey with the Wealth Formula Podcast. And today I'd like to remind you that we have this website called wealthformula.com with an abundance of resources for you to check out. In addition, you can join our accredited investor club, which is really where all the magic happens. This is the information, that's the playing field, right? So you got to get your education on, and then you got to go implement it. And that's what the accredited investor group is for. So check that out at wealthformula.com. Also, if you're interested, there is a book that you can download called Seven Secrets of Eternal Wealth, an Amazon bestseller that I wrote. You can download that there, or you can simply text 44222 and type Wealth Formula one word, and you will get that to your phone. It's the magic of technology. So let's talk about today's show. You know, I was reading an article about the 4% rule. Have you heard of the 4% rule? I'm guessing you have, as it seems to be, you know, sort of this magical number espoused by traditional financial advisors and bloggers alike. I see it all the time. And the idea is that you should be able to safely withdraw 4% of your stocks and bonds, mutual funds portfolio to live on for retirement for the rest of your life, presumably, although some people say that's not the case, but that's what I've read. The idea is that theoretically this 4% withdrawal should be able to sustain you, because traditionally the growth of your portfolio will be greater than that, and therefore you would have principal preservation. Now, understand that that 4% is also based on a portfolio that is supposed to be significantly weighted by fixed income and dividends. Now, is it simple like that? Is it really that simple? Well, maybe it is, and maybe this podcast is completely worthless, and, you know, we should all just try to be driving in a bunch of money, and just until we get to that 4% point, you know, get your $1 million and live on $40,000 a year. Sounds like a dream to me, doesn't it? Listen, maybe it's simple, maybe it is, but maybe that's, and maybe all of this will just work out for you if that's what you do. I mean, frankly, that's what all of our friends are doing, folks. As you may have guessed, though, I am a little bit more skeptical about that rule myself. Why? Well, for one thing, I'm a real estate guy. So that's not really fair. You see, I'm just biased. I'm a guy who likes income producing assets with tax benefits that I can see, touch, and feel, things that I can use leverage on safely and multiply my returns. All that stuff that I talk about on this show, it just doesn't really fit in for me personally. But the bigger problem that I see with this 4% rule is that, frankly, it's based on old data. Specifically, if you go back and you dig into this whole 4% rule thing, you realize that the modeling uses data, the data from 1926 to 1976, all right? So a lot of you were not even born. That's the data we're using to determine the fate of your retirement. To me, that's a little bit concerning. You see, The underlying assumptions of the 4% rule are that most of the portfolio income, again, is produced from dividends and fixed income. What is fixed income, you ask? Well, fixed income comes from bonds. And of course, bond yields are significantly reflective of what interest rates are doing. Now, I don't need to remind you that we are at historical low interest rate levels now, and our president is absolutely demanding negative rates. Now, how does that make you feel about the 4% rule now? Makes me feel a little bit concerned. I mean, not for myself, because I'm not really, you know, thinking about those kinds of rules because they're too generic for me to feel comfortable with. But it makes me feel very concerned for my professional colleagues, okay, doctors and lawyers and engineers. Listen, they all follow this 4% paradigm like it's religion. And while it may work out, it sure doesn't sound like a risk that I would personally want to take. Listen, we live in unparalleled times, right? I mean, negative interest rates across the world, this has never happened. And so how in the world can we use 100-year-old data to guide us into retirement? I mean, how is that possible? And I'll tell you what, there's no way I'm doing that. But the problem is that most of our colleagues will, and all we can do is watch them like an accident ready to happen, hoping that they survive, right? Big collision coming. Let's just cross our fingers and hope that, you know, things turn out for them. In the meantime, what do we need to do? All right. You know, we have our own ways, right? We talk about, but probably the biggest thing, in my opinion, is financial education. That's what we need to arm ourselves. It's the best weapon in defense to use against going broke, dying broke. And in line with that, my guest on Wealth Formula podcast today, he is a financial advisor, but he's also an author and educator. And I've invited him to learn about the biggest financial sector on earth, the bond market. You know, he's a guy who's written some really good basic books on that. And listen, without understanding the bond market, you cannot understand the economy. So this is something that you're not going to want to miss. So when we come back, Russell Wilde on bonds and the bond market.
Worried about saving too little too late for retirement? The Wealth Accelerator may be exactly what you need. With the help of some of the oldest and most reliable insurance companies in the country, Wealth Accelerator allows you to take most of the upside of any good year in the stock market and use bank loans to magnify those returns significantly. And what if the stock market has a bad year? No need to fear. Wealth Accelerator is engineered so you don't participate in the losses of the market, no matter how bad of a year it is. Sounds too good to be true, right? But it's not. It's simply the same financial engineering that the ultra wealthy have been doing for years. Now it's your turn. Check it out for yourself by going to wealthformulabanking.com. Again, that's wealthformulabanking.com.
Self-storage is a necessary evil. It's where you keep your stuff and forget about it. No wonder this stuff is so profitable and recession-resistant. The Wealth Formula community, well, we've benefited from that. We've made lots of money in this space with Reliant Real Estate, one of the largest self-storage companies in the country. With an average investor internal rate of return of almost 34%, with hold times just over 3.5 years, these guys know what the meaning of velocity of money is. If you're an accredited investor, make sure to check out what they're up to right now at ReliantFund4.com. Again, that's ReliantFund4.com.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, my guest on Wealth Formula podcast is Russell Wilde. He's a principal of Global Portfolios, an investment advisory firm based in Philadelphia. In addition to the fun he has with his financial calculator, Wilde is also an accomplished writer who helps readers understand and make choices about their money. And amongst numerous publications, Russell is the author of Investing in Bonds for Dummies, which is what caught my eye, and Investing in ETFs for Dummies, which we'll also cover as well. Russell, welcome to Wealth Formula Podcast.
Thanks, Buck. Pleasure to be here.
So give us a little bit of background on yourself. I mean, obviously, you do this professionally as an advisor, but also, you know, how'd you get into writing and all this?
Well, I've been a fee-only advisor. Fee-only means I work directly with clients, only for clients. I take no commissions. I've been a fee-only advisor since 2003. Mm-hmm. And before that, I had spent a few decades as a writer, writing primarily about finance. Way back when, I got an MBA in finance, and I worked as a credit analyst for a large bank that's now out of business. But I didn't really like working in a large bank. Quit when I was 28 and got into writing. And I guess after writing about finance for more than a decade or so, I got to a point where I felt I knew at least as much, if not more, as the people I was interviewing.
Yeah.
So I went back and got a graduate certificate in financial planning. This was 2001, 2002, and spent about 6 months working for another advisor, and in 2003 hung out my shingle, and I've been doing that ever since, both the writing and the financial planning.
Got it. Now, I know you have a background in, what's not necessarily alternative investing, which is what we typically focus on here, but you wrote this book on investing in bonds for dummies. And again, I'm thinking to myself, that pretty much describes me when it comes to investing in bonds. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about bonds and the bond market. So very broadly speaking, and understanding that this is an audience of very smart people, but we've not really necessarily been educated on this, the role of the bond market and equity markets. What exactly is the bond market? Let's go that basic.
Well, let me start off by saying when you talk about alternative investments, I think of hedges to the stock market. And as far as I'm concerned, although bonds are not an alternative investment by any means, they are, in my mind, the only really time-proven hedge to right. investing in stocks. And we're talking, when I'm talking time, I'm talking literally thousands of years.
Yeah.
A bond is basically an IOU.
Okay.
It is an IOU.
Yep.
You give your money to a government, such as the U.S. government, which issues treasuries. That's what the U.S. government bonds or IOUs are called. Or you give your money to a corporation or to a municipality. And they take your money and they pay you back a fixed interest rate. That's why bonds are alternatively called fixed income.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy a $1,000 bond paying 5%, you'll get $50 a year for as long as you hold that bond. The bond price may go up and down, but you're going to get $50 a year regardless. And that's really all a bond is. The bond market is enormous,
right.
much larger than the stock market. Here in the United States, the world bond market is about $100 trillion. $1 trillion is a million million or a thousand billion. To put that in relation to the stock market, of that $100 trillion, the U.S. bond market is about $40 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
That compares to the U.S. stock market. The value of all stocks, all American stocks, adds up to $30 trillion. So the bond market is very, very important, both to the issuers of the bonds, the corporations, municipalities, and government, and, of course, to the lenders, to us, those of us who invest in bonds.
So let's talk about the role of bonds in traditional investing portfolios. So presumably it is the, it's the hedge against the equities, right? I mean, is there more to it than that?
Well, I have to ask you, are we talking about the role as it is or the role as it should be? Okay. In my mind, the role as it should be, I think bonds serve two purposes in a portfolio, or should serve two purposes in a portfolio. One is as ballast. Typically, when the stock market goes down, people rush to safety. Safe bonds, we assume treasuries are safe. We assume the government is not going bankrupt. Safe bonds, when the stock market goes down, usually go up in price.
Mm-hmm.
In part because of simple supply and demand. It's a little more complicated than that. But there tends to be an inverse relationship between safe bonds, such as treasuries, and the stock market. Doesn't always work that way. Usually it does. In 2008, for instance, when everything went to hell, every kind of stock, every stock of every nation, REITs, everything went down in 2008, except for treasuries. Treasuries went up. The second reason to hold bonds in a portfolio is dry powder. Mm-hmm. So if you're holding a portfolio, let's say, of 50% stock, 50% bonds, and you have a crash like 2008, suddenly, without touching your portfolio at all, you have 25% stock, because the stock market at one point went down 50%. Now stocks are presumably selling at bargain basement prices. You want something to be able to turn into cash so you can buy the stocks. So right. Those are the two purposes bonds should serve in a portfolio. Unfortunately, when interest rates drop as low as they have, and they are, one pundit said the other day, they're as low as they've been since Sumerian times. Right. I thought he was kidding, but he was serious. Yeah. He may be right. Bond interest rates worldwide are extremely low. And at times like this, people get desperate for yield. So people start investing in junk bonds, high yield, otherwise known as junk bonds. And those do not serve as a hedge. Junk bonds tend to go up with the stock market and down with the stock market. They are not ballast. They are not dry powder. And in the long run, they don't return nearly as much as stocks. So I rarely use junk bonds in any of my portfolios.
So, you know, you brought up a good, you brought up something I think is interesting. The idea that, you know, even with the bond market and interest rates continuing to go down, you know, that the yield on the bonds may not be quite what they were in the past. One of the things that, you know, I had recently read was the idea of, you know, how the often cited 4% rule, and that the 4% rule being that, you know, the idea being that if you, you know, if you want to retire and you can safely take out 4% per year out of your, you know, your portfolio and live on it forever, but that was based on data from another time, that the data was compiled about 20 years ago. So it's missed all of what we've seen, and certainly has missed the these crazy negative interest rates and these environments. How does that affect, and maybe you don't agree with the assessment, maybe it doesn't affect it, but how does that affect this whole 4% rule paradigm that I think a lot of people still use?
Well, the 4% rule does not say you can live forever. The 4% yes. rule is based on someone of average retirement age, mid-60s, living an average lifespan, maybe 20, 25 years. So what the 4% rule says is if you have a diverse portfolio and you withdraw 4% a year, adjusted for inflation, that is, you take 4% of your first year's portfolio balance and each year you bump it up for inflation, you have a good chance, or a very good chance, of not outliving your money if you live 20, 25 years. Does the 4% rule now hold in times of very low interest rates? That's a very good question. The 4% rule has looked at time frames over history, and initially it looked at, well, what if you retired in 1929, and 1930, and 1931? From 1929 up until, you say, about 20 years ago, the 4% rule held tight. There was never a 25-year period where you would have run out of money had you limited your withdrawals to 4%. With interest rates so low, I am suggesting that people in their mid-60s might want to limit their withdrawals to 3.5% a year. Mm-hmm. I don't think today's low interest rates are extremely low by historical standards. Yes, perhaps they're the lowest nominal interest rate since Sumerian times. However, inflation is very low.
Yeah.
So your real return on bonds right now is lower than the historical average, but not that much lower.
Got it. So, you know, I'm particularly interested in the role of bonds as they relate to the global economy. And because of that, I think it's a good idea for us to understand the market better than I think most people do. Can you give us a high level? Obviously, the pure size of the bond market is a big reason for that. But why is it important to follow the bond market if you want to know what's going on with the global economy?
Gosh, The road you drove on to get to work today was probably built on money that your municipality raised by issuing bonds.
Right.
So bonds are really the great wheel greaser of modern society. When governments want to run a deficit, as almost all Western governments are these days, they do it by issuing bonds. There's no other way they could do it if they're spending more than they're raising in taxes. Municipalities often run with deficits. They want to build a tunnel. They want to build a new street, put in train tracks. They almost always will sell bonds to raise the money. Corporations the same way. It's usually a lot cheaper in the long run for corporations to issue bonds than to issue stocks and give away a piece of the corporation. So bonds that have corporations that have a good credit rating generally will prefer to raise cash to expand by selling bonds rather than issuing stock.
Right. So let's talk about, for example, U.S. Treasuries, and U.S. Treasury notes are basically, you know, bonds to the U.S. government, right? You're lending money to the U.S. government.
Yes.
Are they, what can we look at in terms of the correlation between the price of U.S. Treasury notes and inflation?
Well, the general thought, and empirically we have seen, when interest rates are lowered, it tends to pump prime the economy. People will tend to spend more because it's easier to borrow. Companies will tend to expand more and hire more because their borrowing costs are lower. Right. So when people are spending more, inflation rises. There are many, many correlates between the two, but I would say that that's the main one. And yeah. Conversely, when interest rates rise, it tends to contract the economy, and that tends to lower inflation. Right now, we have very low interest rates and very low inflation because strange things start to happen when interest rates get too low. And they're getting to that point in the United States, and they are beyond that point in Europe and Japan, where you mentioned negative interest rates. We don't have that now. We could get to that point. In Europe and Japan right now, if you want to buy treasuries, although it flux from day to day, you may have to actually pay the government to keep your money stored. You're going to get a negative rate of return. And never mind, we could talk about negative interest rates and what they mean if you wish. But even in an environment where what we have now in the United States, 10-year treasuries, last I looked, were paying about 1.6%. Just keep even with inflation. So funny things start to happen when interest rates get that low, because the most rapidly rising demographic, growing demographic in America is the elderly. We're going to have way more retired people in 10, 20 years than we do now. Mm-hmm. So these people historically, my parents, very likely your parents, they had fixed pensions, and any other money they needed usually came from their treasury portfolio. And they might be getting 8, 9, 10, or 12%. Nowadays, people moving into retirement are very nervous, because if they buy a bond portfolio, they're going to get squat. They're going to keep even with inflation now, and chances are for quite some years to come, because current yields are a good predictor of future stock market returns over the next several years. So when you get interest rates that low, retirees start to freak and they start to spend less. So instead of expanding the economy, the lower interest rates can actually backfire at this point and start shrinking the economy. And I think that's what we're seeing now in Europe. So when you go to the extreme, the negative interest rates, even in Japan and Europe, have not helped grow the economy, which is one reason why the stock market has done.
Thought is that part of it, the reason, because it is curious to me that has been so, for the most part, completely ineffective in Europe.
Yeah.
But that it's a psychological element of the fear that comes with an economy that requires a negative interest rate.
Well, there's that too. Sure, that's what I find so fascinating about economics, which was my major in college. I just love the there's so many interactions. Yes, right. Interest rates Well, actually, there are two interesting things here. We should talk about the inverse yield curve. Mm-hmm. So right now, you can get as much on cash in very short-term bonds as you can in long-term bonds. And that's called a flat or an inverse yield curve because day-to-day it fluxes, but you can actually sometimes get more these days on short-term bonds. Yeah. Than long-term bonds. So that reflects a certain nervousness. People are taking money and putting them in long-term bonds for fear that interest rates may drop lower. And why do they fear that interest rates may drop lower? They are cautious about the state of the economy.
And that is that's the inversion curve that everybody is kind of freaking out about when it happened.
Inverted yield curve.
Yep. Yeah, the inverted yield curve.
Well, I don't know if people are freaking out. I mean, you know, it's a way that you can keep short-term bonds and earn as much as if you were had long-term bonds. So some people are saying, well, why should I have any long-term bonds? Because long-term bonds, they're not as volatile as stocks, but they can be volatile. Well, my answer to that is you want both, because interest rates may in fact go down, in which case, as we've seen over the last month, bond prices will go up.
Right. When that inversion has happened, it's been predictive of recessions typically. Is that not true?
Yeah, there's a correlation there, but there are many correlations in economics.
Sure.
And I wouldn't by any means say that the inverse yield curve is a sure sign that we're going to have a recession, by no means.
Let's talk about a little bit, you know, our audience is pretty real estate focused in general, and we're concerned about mortgage rates, which are, you know, they're different, obviously, than Fed funds rate. Mortgage rates might be better correlated with the 10-year treasury price. Is that true?
They're correlated to treasury prices. When we talk about treasuries, we often use 10-year treasury as a proxy for treasuries, because mm-hmm. treasuries are issued in weeks, months, 2 years, 5 years, up to 20, 30 years. They're talking about creating a longer-term treasury now. So that the average is more or less 10 years. So when you talk about the treasury rate, perforce, you're talking about the 10-year treasury rate. Is there a correlation between the 10-year treasury rate and mortgage rates? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Generally, all interest rates tend to move up and down together. There are many reasons why there's so much connectivity, but in a way, treasuries compete with the bonds that are issued that hold mortgages. So mortgage-backed securities are a large part of the total bond market. Those mortgage-backed securities compete with treasuries. When treasuries are paying low yields, the mortgage-backed securities like the Ginnie Mae's and Freddie Mae's, those can then sell on the market for lower interest, and therefore the banks can lend you money for less because they can borrow money for less.
So there was this recent... it just popped in my head. I'd be good to get your thoughts on this. There's recent event in the repo markets where, you know, basically there was an emergency injection of capital by the Federal Reserve. I was wondering if it makes sense for you to talk a little bit about that and tell us if you know, what that was all about. And you were reading about it in the newspaper and a lot of people were going, I don't know what that is. I've read it. I don't really understand, what, if any, significance there is to it. But could you address that a little bit?
Well, there are two ways that the government generally can prime an economy, or if inflation is running high, slow an economy down. And one is called fiscal policy. That's what you're talking about, actually. Well, what you're talking about is a combination of monetary and fiscal policy. Fiscal policy refers to government spending. When the government spends money, people get hired. When roads are being built and tunnels are being built, it boosts the economy. So when the government spends more, it tends to boost the economy. The government spends less, it tends to slow the economy. Then there's monetary policy, and that is largely through manipulation of interest rates, which the government has a lot of power over. The government can either speed the economy up by lowering interest rates or slow the economy down, that is, slow inflation down by raising interest rates. So again, things now are not working the way they should. So the The government is taking some extreme measures at times to keep things in balance. There's a lot of fear of recession. We're not in a recession. And I don't want to veer into politics, but I think it's a big mistake right now for the government to continue lowering interest rates, because we will wind up in a trap like Europe, and there will be no place left to go. And the government will stop having the tools. The ammunition will be taken away from the government to help the economy in times of real need. Now is not such a time.
Yeah. I noticed in addition to the bonds book, there was another book that you had written regarding ETFs. And I thought it'd be a good chance to ask you about this. You know, there was a hedge fund manager, Dr. Barry, who's kind of famous for that, you know, the big, what was it? The big, I know everybody's like, come on, you know what it is. Anyway, The Big Short. And The Big Short movie, where he basically called the housing market. Dr. Burry was, sort of the star of the show there. He's come out and talked about an ETF bubble, basically the idea of these, all these ETFs that are sort of, people consider this sort of a type of passive investing, just buying the market. I wonder if you would talk a little bit about, Dr. Burry's assessment of the ETF space, and if you agree, disagree.
It was a fun article, and I talked to a bunch of my financial planning buddies about it. The general consensus is there's some small truth to what he was saying, but it's nothing that should keep people up at night. But let me back up. Exchange-traded funds, ETFs, mm-hmm. are, at least they started off as basically index funds that trade like stocks on an exchange. For all intents and purposes, they're very similar to index mutual funds that have existed for a long time. Jack Bogle just died. He was, I think, 100 years old, and he was the father of index funds. So for 40 years or so, we've had index funds. Index funds track indexes. So an index fund might pick an index like the S&P 500, buy up all the stocks in the S&P 500, which is not necessarily 500, but close to it, stocks. Mm-hmm. And it's been well known for a long time that an index was originally created as a way of tracking investments. It wasn't meant as an investment vehicle. So why would you want to invest in the S&P 500? There's really no good reason. But the S&P 500, when you turn on CNBC, when you look at the Wall Street Journal, the stock market is often the S&P 500. It's a very popular index. And it's been known for some time that if you invest in the S&P 500, to a certain extent, not a great extent, you're shooting yourself in the foot. Because companies that become part of the S&P 500, on the day they become a member of the S&P 500, their stock tends to go up a little bit. The stock, the manager of the index fund, whether it's a mutual fund or an ETF, has to buy that stock as soon as it enters the S&P 500. So he's buying it at a slightly inflated price. And then the converse, if a stock goes down, becomes ejected from the S&P 500, the index fund manager has to sell. And so he's selling, and usually the price goes down at that point a little bit, and the stock manager has to sell. So those of us in the know are not great fans of buying ETFs or stock mutual funds that track very popular indexes. So to that extent, what he's saying is true. Maybe. It depends where the investors
come. I can interrupt for a second. The idea, just to kind of put this in perspective, the idea is that, like, effectively, that if you're saying, if you're buying an ETF, an S&P 500 ETF, if you're buying into that, because these stocks sort of get lumped together, in many cases, the price to earnings ratios are maybe artificially elevated. Is that fair?
To a small degree, yeah. Entering the S&P, your stock's not going to double. It may go up a few pennies.
Right.
We have seen that. It usually does.
So what is the, maybe you're getting to this, but what's the danger specifically that Dr. Burry is referring to?
Well, if everybody invested in SPY, the S&P, the most popular S&P 500 ETF, which I believe holds more assets than any other ETF, if everybody in America suddenly bought SPY, then this effect that we're talking about would become more significant. However, there are thousands of ETFs out there. Not everybody is buying SPY. A certain number of people who buy SPY are coming from S&P 500 mutual funds, so there's not going to be any real bubble creation there. Generally, I would say if you're going to buy an ETF and you're afraid of a bubble, then just don't buy an ETF that's tracking one of the most popular indexes. There are plenty of them out there. But conversely, as I said earlier, indexes were meant to track investments, not to be investments. And there are some ETFs right now where the purveyors are creating their own indexes. And you want to make sure if you're buying into a created index that it's an index that makes sense and an index that belongs in your portfolio.
Got it. So what is, I guess, just in terms of your personal recommendations right now, how are you looking at, you know, the economy as it is right now? You know, what are you telling your clients? And, you know, obviously we're just going to look for a little bit of free advice from you at this point and mostly just trying to get your perspective on where we are in the economy, what's going on and how, you know, generally speaking that you have been guiding your clients' behavior on that.
Well, I'd say my number one finance guru is Yogi Berra because he said predictions are very hard to make, especially when they involve the future.
Right, exactly.
And I refuse to do it. When you turn on CNBC, when you look at any financial magazine, mm-hmm. money magazine, you name it, most of the pages are devoted to trying to predict the future. And, you right. know, it doesn't work any better in stocks. It doesn't work any better in bonds than it does sure. in trying to predict, you name it, the weather a year from now. It really doesn't. And this has been very well studied. So I always recommend that my clients build very diversified portfolios with many stocks and many industries and many countries, and a diversified portfolio of bonds with long-term, short-term, bonds of different countries and treasuries, corporates, and municipals. With that being said, right now, the outlook on bonds, I'm going to correct what I said. Bonds, unlike stocks, there is some predictability. And that is, you look at the current yield, which I said is about 1.6% on treasuries. That's probably going to be your return on bonds over the next 5-6 years. Because if interest rates go up, bond prices drop. Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. You know, you're probably going to break even with inflation on your bond portfolio in the near intermediate future. And therefore, a lot of people, as we talked about, are buying junk bonds, trying to get higher yield. I think that's a mistake. Or they're going more into stocks than they should. And I think that's a big mistake. Stocks have always been risky. They always will be risky. And retirees just have to, or people who want to sleep well at night, you just got to bite the bullet and you got to deal with these low interest rates. Perhaps you need to spend less. Perhaps you need to extend your retirement a few months. Don't shoot me. I'm just a messenger. But I think going into stocks, especially for people at the cusp of retirement or just starting retirement, is not a good idea.
Got it. So tell us a little bit more about your practice and, you know, how people can get a hold of you if they're interested.
I'm here in beautiful Philadelphia. My firm name is Global Portfolios. My website is globalportfolios.net. And I am, again, strictly fee only. I take no commissions. I work directly with clients and only for clients. I am a fiduciary. That's the way I've always run my business and always will.
Russell, thanks so much for being in Wealth Formula Podcast.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Back. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Listen, I hope you enjoyed that that interview. I did. I really liked it. I think Russell's a really nice guy, very clear. And, you know, I may not have similarities in terms of, you know, investment philosophy and stuff. For me, the problem is I just don't see how you can lump in all these individual stocks and even these ETFs and these individual bonds and create, you know, portfolios that have a level of predictability, especially in this market that, you know, really is unparalleled. And so that's really what concerns me. And frankly, I don't like that kind of systemic risk. I'd rather be in real estate again. I you know, I can control this stuff a lot better than I can control any stock price. So anyway, it doesn't matter to me whether that describes you or not. What I'd really like everyone to do is just become educated. And as long as you, you know, take a chance to try to teach yourself all this stuff, you make the decision, you know, you make the decision for yourself, what you think is the right thing for you. Because what you don't want to do is, you know, in a situation when you're, you know, quote unquote, retiring 20, 30 years from now or whatever, and thinking, gosh, I wish I'd known that there would be as other options and theories, and maybe I wouldn't be in the financial predicament that I am now. On the other hand, if you actually knew what you were doing and at least made some decisions yourself, if you ended up in that situation, you may not feel that bad about it. Anyway, you know, this is the first, one other thing I want to mention is this is the first show after the Wealth Formula Meetup, Wealth 2.0. And I don't know how it went because I'm recording this before the show actually airs. I'll be flying back as this is released. So hopefully it went well. I'm guessing it did. And if you like that kind of environment where you can meet those other people and talk about stuff like, you know, like we talked about at the event, real estate, taxes, asset protection, all that good stuff, check out our private group, Wealth Formula Network. That's where we do. We have a course. We have a private Facebook group. We have a portal and also bi-weekly Zoom video calls with yours truly. And that's really fun. It's become a really nice little online community. Check that out. Join us, wealthformularoadmap.com. That's it for me this week. This is Buck Joffrey signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Formula Podcast. Visit us on the web at wealthformula.com. The information contained in this podcast are opinions, not fact. As always, consult your own financial team before making any investment. See you next time.
Buck Joffrey here from Sapio with Buck Joffrey. Aging might become reversible over the next 10 to 20 years. It's already being done in lab animals, so it's just a matter of time. Our challenge? To be healthy enough for when that time comes. As a former scientist and surgeon myself, my goal is to figure out how to do that and to share it with you. I wrote a book called Living Longer for Busy People that you can download for free at sapiopodcast.com. You'll be amazed at just how a few daily adjustments can add years of a healthy life for you. Again, download it for free, sapiopodcast.com.